Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest today is Charles Torello. Charles is the author of a book called Tales from the Golden Bevo, and we will be talking to Charles in just a moment. First, we'll do the morning or the market reports. Used to do morning reports when I was in the Army. It's been a long time since I did any morning reports. So we're going to do not the morning report. We're going to do the market report. Gold is up $10.60 to $1,334.60 per ounce. Silver's up 9 cents, $21.92. Platinum's down $1 to $1,431 per ounce. Palladium is up 3 to $727. Dow Jones is down 60 points to 15,275. NASDAQ is off 7 points to 3,761. New York Stock Exchange is down almost 5 points to 9,710. U.S. dollar index is down 0.29 to 80.29 on the U.S. dollar index. And crude oil is off 80 cents to $102.33 per barrel. Charles Torello is, I've known him since he was a fat, long-haired high school kid back about 20 years ago. I know Charles because his father's a good friend of mine. Charles started playing football when he's 5 years old. He won significant recognition as a high school player, and he became All-American. All-American college football player at Rice University. He was a guard. The thing that impressed me most about Charles was a time about 4 years ago when his dad, Charles, and I went to a Rice college football game. We sat in the stands with four of Charles' old college team members. When Charles went to the concession stand to buy something to eat, I heard his team members talking about him, and they all solemnly agreed that Charles was the toughest man they'd ever met. They were serious. You understand? Charles played college ball, 310 pounds. He slimmed down to 240, but he's still a big boy and a dangerous-looking man. What you might not guess from his appearance is that he's also a teacher who really cares about the welfare of the kids in his classes. He's a bit of a philosopher, a compulsive truth-seeker, and the author of a recent book, again entitled Tales from the Golden Bevo. We'll explain that title in a moment. The book focuses on the dark side of the University of Texas Longhorn football team, where Charles worked for 2 years. It's also a memoir of Charles's own education and some of his insights into subjects like character and dignity, love of money, and the American education system, democracy, and even the Republican form of government that's guaranteed in our Constitution are all touched on in Charles' book. Charles Torello, bit of a man for all seasons. Welcome.
Hello, Alfred. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you, Charles?
Well, the only thing that I really take issue with what you just said is that I have never had long hair in all my life.
Oh yeah, I remember. I remember you had hair. I know you couldn't have long hair now, Charles. But back then, I remember when your dad brought you over to the house. You had, well, I don't know. Well, I guarantee it was a lot longer than it is today, Charles.
Yeah. Well, that's not saying a whole lot.
20 years ago, I understand that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Tell us about the title to your book, "Tales from the Golden Bevo." Now that's going to be a little bit obscure for most people. What's the Golden Bevo all about? And give us a synopsis of the book, or what's the theme of the book?
Well, that's a very fair question, and I, of course, realize that it is quite vague to a great many people, especially who know nothing about the world of college football or who know next to nothing about the University of Texas. But Bevo is the name of the mascot, of the Longhorn mascot for the University of Texas. And, you know, it's this big, big, nasty, slobbering bovine creature that, you know, the story of the naming of Bevo, well, that's not necessary right now. But Golden Bevo is a sort of takeoff, well, it's a direct takeoff of the golden calf of the Book of Exodus. And I don't know how familiar all the readers are with the Book of Exodus and all that, but Moses is leading the people out of their bondage in Egypt through the Sinai wilderness, and he goes up on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, and the people get restless, and they don't know what to do, and so they think Moses has basically just vanished, and so they throw in all their gold together, and they create this golden calf, and they bow down, and they worship it. And so why Golden Bevo? Well, to be perfectly blunt, my time at the Longhorn football program very, very quickly taught me that the auspices that the program exists for are really just a mask. You know, imagine that, Alfred. In the United States of America, there's a lot of institutions that purport one thing and do another, which is the essential definition of hypocrisy. And so the Longhorn football program, I came to see very quickly, is all about the money. And it's kind of hard, you know, as amazing as it may be that this institution, which generates $100 million a year in revenue, and it generates more than that a year now, and that's not even including the alumni donations that they get. You know,
did you say $100 million?
Last year, as of 2012, the revenues for football alone, I believe,
for University of Texas.
No, for the football program. For the football program was $103 million.
All right.
So you know,
serious
obviously
money.
That's serious money. Obviously, it's not chump change. It's not. Anyway. So the whole culture of the program, the whole nature of it is so overtly skewed towards the maximization of revenues. It's you know, it's all about the money, and the love of money, as Paul said in I think Colossians, is the root of all evil. And he also said that covetousness, which is the love of money, is the same sin as idolatry. So it just really struck me that what the place is really all about is this the Golden Bevo. You know, they're go
worshiping out and their own golden calf. And the point then is, who's being hurt by this?
Well,
I mean, everybody would like to have more money, Charles. And the question becomes, who's being injured by this love of money down at the University of Texas? And not just for the Longhorns. I'm going to guess that this is true for most of the major college teams throughout the country. Is that a fair reading or not?
Oh, I would say that I would say it's definitely so for a lot of programs. I mean, especially the big money programs. But regards who's being hurt, well, you know, I think football has in this country has turned into some sort of quasi-religion that is kind of out of control for some people. And you know, I can still enjoy watching a football game, but I think some people take it way too far. And there's this very powerful vainglory associated with playing the sport that just is such a magnet to so many youth. And I haven't really done any extensive studies on the amount of injuries, concussions, and all the debilitating things that young kids go through in pursuit of the glory of playing football. But I imagine it's a lot, you know. And
I remember Howie Long on NFL Today. He's one of the spokesmen. You see him there. He's still there. And back several years ago, I can't remember when, he pointed out that the average life expectancy for a professional football player who'd played, I think it was 5 years. If you'd played 5 years in the sport, most people only play about 3 years, but if you played 5 years, your life expectancy was reduced to 55 years of age.
Yeah.
Which means
yep.
The people who really, really believe in football and really play the game are actually shortening their lives on average in pursuit of this, you know, in pursuit of whatever objectives we've got, the money, the winning, whatever. And part of the point then is football has become something far more than a mere game. It's not just a question where we go out and let's throw the pigskin around and play out in the street or out in the backyard or whatever. This place has become extraordinarily serious and perhaps even dangerous. How's it working out for the kids?
Well, I mean, all that, of course, depends upon a kid-per-kid basis. Some come out of their college career relatively unscathed. You know, I started all 44 games of my college career, and I consider myself very fortunate to not have sustained any real significant injuries, but I very much can feel as I get older, my knees and my back particularly beginning to weaken and beginning to feel more pain than they did in the past. And I really don't look forward to what I'm going to feel like 10, 20 years from now because of football. And so there's definitely the injury aspect of it all that some should consider, especially considering that the whole college football experience. I mean, you know, you in sports, you definitely can learn dedication and discipline and commitment and perseverance and forbearance and all those good things. But, you know, it's not like any of the skills that you learn that are pertinent to the football field carry over to any other part of life. I mean, I've never had to perform a power clean ever since my football days are done. You know, I've never had to block a three technique on the defensive lineman again. You know, it's so you dedicate.
But I'll bet you've been tempted from time to time, haven't you, Charles?
Well, I certainly won't go into the situation in which I was tempted.
Well, we might get to it before the program's over. But I'll tell you what, we've got a call.
Goodness.
We've got one caller from Grant is calling from Texas. And he called almost as soon as the program began. I wanted to get it rolling before we talked to Grant. Grant, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question and comment?
Well, I've been reading the website. I've really enjoyed a lot of the stuff. I grew up out in Richardson. I live in Austin now. And the longer I've been in Austin, the more people I know connected to the university. And I've been hearing a lot of stuff about Mack Brown and all his I guess you could call it evil doings, maybe carrying over into other programs there, his control carrying over. I'm wondering if Charles knows anything about it carrying into other programs or into, like, being an architect of 9/11 or Oklahoma City bombing or anything like that.
All right. Thank you, Grant. Charles, what do you think? What do you know about Mac? Is he an evil genius? Is he an evil genius behind pulling strings behind the curtains and affecting much of athletics at University of Texas, or is it pretty much confined to the football team? Is he just doing his job? What do you think?
Well, I really cannot answer at all to what goes on in other sports because my time was confined mostly to football. And Grant used the word evil. Now,
no, I used it. I don't know if he used it. I used it.
No. He said evil doings, and not okay. In any very specific context, not in any sort of accusatory context. But I just want to be clear. That's not a word that would necessarily come out of my mouth. Regarding the man's character at all. And I'm not saying that the place is oozing with evil. I'm not saying that. I'm not inferring that, I'm not saying that the Longhorn football program was like the Penn State football program where you had that apparently that pedophile ring going on. Though when the whole Penn State pedophile story came out and people were saying, gee, how could this happen? How could people let this go on at Penn State and blah blah blah? And so the first thing that came through my mind was, well, if it's anything like the Longhorn football program, I guarantee people are very afraid to say anything about it because
it's a cash cow.
Well,
it's not about right and wrong. It's about how much money you're making, and
cash cow.
From that perspective, you want to keep that. You want to keep that. The source of income running, and if that means you have to suppress the truth or, you know, bust a couple of eggs, I guess that's what you do.
Well, yeah, and so, you know, the my time at the program, everything seemed to be laid out by fear and innuendo, and this wasn't just the lowly mentor and tutor type that I was, and I was employed as an academic tutor and proctor for the players. I was the one who kind of did what I could to help the guys pass their classes. And so,
tell us what the definition of proctor is.
Basically,
we can understand mentor and we can understand educator and teacher and that. What is the proctor exactly?
Well, of course, the first thing that goes through my mind when I hear the word proctor is the movie Police Academy with G.W. Bailey screaming for his assistant. But a proctor is like the man who makes sure that there is a degree of order.
Yes, the enforcer.
The enforcer, right? But yeah. I don't want to use the word enforcer because it has a connotation to it that I'm really not trying to imply. So I use the not very used word of proctor, and that's basically what I was hired for. I was hired to see all the Longhorn freshmen. They come into the program. And there are certainly a fair share of them that are capable of performing at the level of their college classes. But
now, you're not talking about performing at a college level athletically. All right? That's not what we're talking about right this minute. We're saying that a lot of these guys are good students.
Yes. Well, you say a lot.
Some of them. Okay, there was one in Guinness. The Guinness Book of Records said there was one.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, some of them, you know, out of a given 23 freshmen, I would say 4 to 5 are definitely capable of doing the work without any help. And so, but that means a majority of them, and a majority of them also, a majority of them do need a helping hand to acculturate themselves to the demands of their college classes.
Because all right, I'll tell you what, Charles, we're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'll be back with Charles Torello, author of Tales from the Golden Bevo, here on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. And speaking of which, Melody's special du jour, today's special, 1/2 ounce gold eagle, a free 1 ounce silver eagle. The price includes shipping, and that's $750. This is almost a giveaway, folks. 1/2 ounce gold eagle. A free 1 ounce silver eagle, $750. Price includes shipping. Give Melody a call, 1-800-375-4188. There's a limited supply on these. They won't last all day, so jump in if you want to jump. All right, I'm here talking to Charles Torello, the author of Tales from the Golden Beagle, and we are talking about the college athletic program, in particular at the University of Texas, the football program, and we are raising some implications about athletics, college athletics in general. And part of where we're going on this, we were talking about the students coming in to play football. You've got 23 college freshmen recruited with scholarships to play football for the University of Texas. And you're telling me that 4 or 5 of them are actually capable of doing a good job in college without any additional help, but you're also saying that 18, 19 of them, they need some help. In fact, if I understand correctly, in your book, you reference dealing with freshman college students who sometimes have a reading level of about a fourth grade. And the question becomes, how are these kids capable of being a college student? And how are they, Charles? How do they manage to make it as a college student?
Well, Alfred, you have touched on an area that I think the program is quite sensitive to have discussed openly on the radio, which I really don't care. I'm going to talk about it anyway. Now, first, with regard to those young men who come in with that very low reading level, I never held any of them in any sort of contempt for the lack of education they came to college with. I do want to say that a young man who does not read at the highest level is not a contemptible character, and he does not deserve contempt, and he does not deserve to be looked down upon. Yes, it is quite the disadvantage, but like all of us, we're all in need of love and care and nurturing and support. And so I talk openly about this, not to disparage those young men's character, because frankly, I thought highly of just about all of them. So I just want to be clear of the context that I'm talking about. But yes, some of them are absolutely, they read at a third and fourth grade level. So the question becomes, how in the world do they have the prowess to pass a college class? Well, that's where the army of mentors and tutors come in. Every freshman player is assigned a mentor that is a sort of fills a sort of secretarial role that oversees all the obligations the player has in his classes, when his tests are, when his papers are due, et cetera, et cetera. And some of the mentors do some of the tutoring, but there's also an army of tutors that help the players with their with whichever subject. And
okay, wait a second. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You say that each player has a mentor.
Yes.
Does that mean that there's only one mentor for each player? And what I mean by that, one player has one mentor, the next player has another, or do we have five players who have the same mentor?
There is some of that. I mean, the mentors have, one mentor can have five players. One mentor can have 10. One mentor can have one. It's all very heavily dependent upon the nature of the rapport between the mentor and the football players. And some mentors are extremely capable and it came to be that a lot of the guys wanted one particular mentor because she was so good at what she did. So it's just whatever works out best is the way it works out. So, but
not everybody's crazy about this mentor concept. If I understand
okay.
correctly, the National College Athletic Association, I mean, they don't necessarily agree with this, because the issue, if you're going to play college ball, The idea is you must maintain your eligibility. This is a big, big focus, according to your book. And that eligibility means you've got to have a certain grade level if you want to play college ball. And if you fall below that grade level, guess what? You're off the team. Now, we have a conflict of interest here between whether or not we want to make sure this young athlete is truly learning, or if he's not capable of learning at the rate we want, but he is capable of playing ball, is he learning or is he playing? Is he a student or is he an athlete, Charles? And you're caught in the middle of that.
Well, that's we're there's so many tangents that we can go from what we've discussed so far. But regarding the term student athlete, that was an invention of the 1950s, about 1957, which has very precise legal implications. And the purpose of its invention was to obfuscate the notion that college football players are, in fact, employees of the university. And it was crucial that the NCAA establish that they're students first, so as not to be considered employees, because as employees, the universities and even the NCAA itself could be liable for workers' compensation claims when the players are injured, as in a multitude of court cases have unfolded over the decades, to where the players have sought some sort of compensation for their injury. And the whole thing started when a football player at some small school in Colorado died because of a head injury he sustained. His wife sued that Colorado University. A lower Colorado court did in fact deem that the players are employees of the university, which is my position. You know, the NCAA will take a different position, and courts have recognized that they are not athletes, but that doesn't mean that they're not the court has recognized that they're not employees, but that doesn't mean that they are truly not fundamentally employees at all. I say they are. And so,
well, here's one of the questions about this that crosses my mind. When you have a student coming to college, an alleged student, who can only read at a fourth grade level, it's clear that he's not there on an intellectual scholarship. It's almost certain, it's not necessarily certain, but it's almost certain that he's not going to be able to do a good job as a student at the university, and that the calling him a student is just a pretext, because what he really is an athlete. And they're bringing him in to play on the team. They don't care if he ever gets an education, because if he's only got a fourth grade reading level by the time he's 18 years old, odds are 4 more years of college isn't going to do a whole lot to improve his reading level or his intellectual capacity, or at least that's the way it seems to me. Will the guy comes into college with fourth grade reading level, will he see, on average, will he get enough improvement, enough help, that he's actually going to do well in college?
It all depends upon the character of the young man. You know, truly, I have seen some with the very low reading levels really try their hardest to do all the work they can to pass their classes. That absolutely does happen. But that's still not to say, though, that the amount of help that they receive is ultimately licit in the eyes of the NCAA. You know, you'd be the bottom. I mean, and I don't think it's an immoral thing to give more help than what the university or the NCAA would deem licit. I don't think it's immoral at all. I think it's immoral not to help the young man. I think it's immoral to sort of wash your hands of him and say, well, you just do it yourself. You know, which is
treating him as purely an athlete rather than a student.
Well,
if the scholarship is for student athletes, the scholarship has to help him be an athlete and also help him be a student, or at least that'd be my that's the way I'm inclined to look at it.
Sure. Well, again, you know, they use the term student athlete to sell the idea that they are students first, and that education really is the priority, and that it, which thus implies that these hulking institutions, the universities and the football programs themselves, that generate just obscene amounts of money, especially considering the incredible rise of tuition rates over the past decade or so. You know, it's not about the money. It's not about maximizing the numbers. It's not, you know, it's really all about the kids and the education and because they love them. You know, like
you're being
like
sarcastic, of course. That's not what you believe. That's not how you believe the colleges really function.
They're in it for the money. I think the universities, the people at the top who control the millions and billions of dollars that the universities earn, I think they really care about the quality of life for the young athletes and the students as much as Barack Obama really cares about my peace and happiness and freedom. I mean, it's pure hypocrisy. You know, it's so rampant in
it's
all.
It's a sales pitch. It's a sales pitch, but it doesn't reflect the reality of the situation. Here's a question I have. If we're going to send a young man to college on a scholarship and argue that his payment, that people are saying insofar as he's going to be paid, he's going to be paid with a scholarship. That's his compensation. He gets to go to college. Well, what is the value of a college education to a boy who can't read above a fourth grade level? It's a little like giving me a book written in Greek on how to fly how to pilot a space shuttle. I'm too old to be an astronaut. I can't read Greek, and the space shuttle's been grounded. It's an interesting book, but what's it got to do with me? It's the same thing, if you catch my drift. What does a college education have to do with at least the average boy who's only reading at a fourth grade level when he's a freshman? Will he ever get anything out of that college education, or will he just get a sheepskin to hang on the wall that doesn't amount to anything?
Well, of course, again, it all depends upon the individual. All depends upon the young man who wants to try or not try.
Give us a percentage on 10. I've got 10 freshmen coming into a football program who read at a fourth grade level.
Okay.
How many of them are going to do well, and how many of them are going to find the education just meaningless?
Well, I would say at least 5 are going to consider it just one ridiculous rigmarole that they have to go to because that they have to go through, because ultimately the vast, you know, I can't give you an exact number, but it is definitely in the majority and probably even a vast majority of the athletes that go to the big money universities, the Texases, the Alabamas, the Oklahomas, so on and so forth. They're there because the carrot has been dangled in front of them to play in the NFL someday and to get a $1 million contract and to have their vanities tickled as they score touchdowns on Sunday. And so that's the big carrot that gets them into these universities, and they're not there. I mean, it's so ridiculous. It's insulting to the intelligence to presume that all these players are really these types that really, really want to be students first, as the NCAA is so.
Truth of the matter is they want to play football.
Well, of course.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, they're dedicated to that sport. They were athletes in high school. They were dedicated to the sport. They like it. Don't blame them a bit. I enjoyed it. I liked playing football. I wasn't very good at it, but I liked it. I love playing basketball. Again, wasn't that good at it, but I loved the game. Given the opportunity, I would love to have played college ball or, who knows, maybe pro ball, but I just never had the talent. Nevertheless, I did have the love. I had the affection. I just didn't have the talent to do that sort of thing. To get back to my earlier question, though, if a guy's coming in with a fourth grade reading level, it's pretty apparent that he's not really coming in. He's not being drafted as a student. He's being drafted as an athlete.
Uh-huh.
I can understand why the students shouldn't be paid. I can understand that argument. But when we sit back and say, except perhaps with a scholarship, but when we see a man who is 90% athlete and 10% student, and that's what, in a sense, maybe that's what the balance is in some of these instances, and we say, well, we're giving him a college education. If that college education is something he'll never take advantage of or be able to use, what's he being paid? Is he receiving any compensation whatsoever? You catch my drift on this?
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. I mean, in one of the chapters of the book that I wrote, it's called An Open Letter to the Texas Longhorns, and I am speaking directly to them, hoping that some of them will read it, and maybe they will. I know some of them have. I've emailed copies of the book to not just a few of them, and I've gotten responses, and not a single one has really been negative. And so what I'm saying is not completely, I'm not going to mention names or when they played and whatnot, not at all. But what I'm talking about is very heartily agreed with by the players themselves. And so, anyway.
You're saying essentially the players understand to some degree they're at least being deceived and maybe even ripped off. And part of the deception, they come in and when they are recruiting players, they assure them that they'll be part of the family.
Uh-huh.
And that's a quote for, that's one of the words you use in your book. You talk about how the coach comes down and says they're going to be part of the family and we're going to take care of them. And what you've said is, there's not really a family there, at least not for most of them.
Well, it's one of the sections of my chapters, I use the phrase den of enmity, because that when I first got there.
I'll tell you what, we're going to say, Charles, why don't we'll hold off on the den of enmity, and we will get right back to it as soon as we get done with these commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with my guest, Charles Torello. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here in Financial Survival with my guest Charles Torella, the author of Tales from the Golden Bevo. It's a book that Charles's memoirs on a number of subjects, primarily his time and what he learned at the University of Texas when he was a tutor, mentor, proctor at the for the college football team, freshman football recruits. We talked about, Charles had just touched on the subject of den of enmity in relation to the claims that we have family in these programs. And let's get back to that, Charles. What do you think?
Well, okay, that is the way it felt when I first got there. And, you know, I started working with the program in the fall of 2009, which was, for those who know, the season that Texas ended up playing Alabama in the national championship game and lost. You know, it was a culture of petty jealousies and gossiping. And, you know, it really wasn't like this happy, loving, wholesome place that that a lot of people expect they might find at a place that is paraded around as a place of family. Now, this is not to say that there were not some very good and wonderful people who were hired to work with the players. There were, and, you know, some of the best people I've met in my life were working there. But overall, it was just kind of like islands in a sea of enmity, so to speak. But for the duration, though that first semester was very tough for me to acculturate myself to what this huge hulking, you know, de facto entertainment corporation expects of peons like myself. It did get a lot better after I had gotten more comfortable there. And so it, although the, you know, that enmity never really seemed far from the surface. And you know, I just, a lot of, I'll be very clearly remember when in 2010, in summer 2010, some of the freshmen for that year come in the summer. They don't report in August as is usual. Mac Brown has the freshmen come in at the beginning of the summer, you know, within 2 weeks after they've graduated high school, and they start their summer school classes right then and there, which I don't mm-hmm. think is a particularly bad idea. I mean, the whole idea of 18-year-old young men goofing off for an entire summer would have been abhorrent 100 years ago. You know, go go bale some hay, get a job, do something. So I, you know, that some people thought it was a bad idea, but I didn't. But I just remember some of the disappointing looks on the faces of not just a few of those freshmen when they first came in, and I'm sort of overseeing them in the computer labs, type papers for classes. One young man was very deliberate to say right in front of me, "I don't like Mac Brown." Within 3 days, he had gotten a totally different perspective of what the culture of the program is like compared to what he had been led to believe that got him to commit there in the first place. Another young man, well, you can read about what he says in the book, and there's a degree of profanity, and it was all actually quite hysterical. But, these two young men were very deliberate to point out in front of me, perhaps because they trusted me and they felt like I was a bit of an honest person and not one of the many plastic characters that do pervade the program, as plastic characters seem to pervade many of the large institutions of American banks and government corporations and whatnot. You feel like you're talking to a hollow person when you do. So, but my point is,
you got a cubicle person inside a cubicle, meaning there's a certain amount of, there's a lot of empty space within that cubicle, and maybe there's a certain amount of empty space within the person who occupies that cubicle in our corporate structure. You talked about the enmity a little bit, and I'm just curious. You talked, if I understand correctly, that the enmity was particularly severe the first semester you were there, which was, if I understand correctly, the semester that University of Texas played Alabama for number one in the country.
It was fall.
Do you think the culture was worse? Well, do you think the culture was more was worse during the seasons when you were winning and there was more on the line? Or was the culture, do you think it was the same even in the seasons when you were losing and nobody gave a damn?
Well, that's a very good question, Alfred. I know that that first semester, though there were some very good young, you know, there were some good men in the freshman class. There was certainly a degree of contempt for my personage, to say the least, from some of those freshmen that came in 2009. I mean, you know, there were times where it was horrible. There were times where I wanted to grab one young man by the throat and, you know, teach him a lesson or two in spite of, you know, he thinks
there's tutoring and there's tutoring. You're going to tutor him in a different subject. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, and it probably would have helped the young man, too. Of course, I probably would have been arrested for assault and at least lost my job. But maybe it all would have been for better. I don't know. But, it was the fall of 2009 when the Longhorns were in the national championship game and the culture at Study Hall. To answer your question, it felt remarkably different compared to the 2010 season when the Longhorns went 5-7. And, you know, that it took about a year for me to get fully comfortable with my role there. And there were certain expectations that I laid down, you know, spoken and unspoken. And, you know, the culture, I mean, not to seem immodest, but the culture definitely of the academic center definitely became more oriented to what I was wanting and what I was expecting, because to be perfectly honest, I would have quit had I been completely prohibited from laying down some expectations of decent behavior, you know, screaming and cussing at the top of your lungs about what you'd like to do to some women in the middle of study hall just is not appropriate. It's not conducive to studying. It's disrespectful to the women. And if
Charles,
I
think you got the basis. I think you've got the basis for a TV situation comedy here, don't you? You know, I mean, this is actually, I can just imagine this. You get that study hall. You got 23 students coming into the study hall that are college scholarship athletes. And I'd have to imagine you could make a heck of a situation comedy out of that. There's good times here and there's bad times. But are the students being adequately, are they really being taken care of, or are they being exploited?
You know, I quit in June 2011 because I simply could not do it anymore. I could not look at these young men, the new freshman class, or the class of 2011 that was about to come in. I quit like a day or two before they would show up, and I simply could not endeavor to act as any sort of authority figure for them under the auspices that my directives toward them to ingratiate and acculturate themselves into the Longhorn football program would have been for their goodness. I could not do it.
You started out believing you'd be able to help these kids. You came to an opinion that the way the system was structured, whatever help you could provide would be minimal or secondary importance. Is that roughly correct?
Oh, well, by the time I quit, sure, it would have just been this, it just felt like the more influence that I won with the players and the more respect that I garnered, that I earned, and that's the thing. I feel like I earned some of their respect. It wasn't conferred upon me by the big bad authoritarian figures of the program, the overseers. You know, I actually earned it. And the more influence, the more respect that I felt I got from them, the more resentment I felt from my higher ups. You know, the more it felt like they wanted me out of there because maybe I was a threat to the hierarchy of their structure, of their control. And I was very frank. I mean, there just came a point during the 2010 season when they're losing, you know, they just kind of gave up and they went 5-7, which should never happen. And oh my gosh, what a tragedy. Yeah, right. But there was this hatred, this contempt that was so liberally uttered by not just a few of the overseers about the character of the young men who were losing the games. And it just enraged me. It infuriated me. You know, I consider it an honor for you to be working with youth that your understanding and your words and your care and your character is ultimately to help improve and better their characters. That's an honor. But to not disregard that, to disregard that entirely and to see them as commodities that are not performing up to par and to conjure hatred in their heart for them because of that. I mean, you know, I left the study hall and academic center a couple of times having quite the conversation with myself that maybe some people on the street thought I was nuts, but you know,
that's what makes for a good book, Charles. First thing you do is you start talking to yourself, and when you get tired of talking to yourself, then you write a book. Where can folks get a copy of your book, Charles?
They can go to goldenbevo.com, and the
spell
book
Bevo
is,
to them. Spell it out.
Yes, sir. It's GOLDENBEVO, BEVO.com. It's goldenbevo.com, Golden Bevo being one word, no slashes, no spaces, no anything like that. And the book is in electronic format only as of now. It's in a PDF form. It's in Mobi and EPUB form, which are usable on the various handheld reading devices today, which I don't have, and I don't even really know how many there are now. But the book is $1.99. I mean, it's really not any sort of grand expenditure at all. And so it's only in electronic form right now, but goldenbevo.com.
All right. We'll talk. We'll pass that out one more time before the program ends, but I wanted to get it in at least once now, and we'll get it in a little bit later in the program. We'll get it in at the end of the program. We'll tell you folks again. You've got a lot of insight about what happened at the University of Texas. The insight applies almost certainly to most other athletic programs, at least at the big universities that have really competitive. I mean, that's so. And one of your points, and perhaps one of your biggest points, is that you think these kids ought to be paid for the work they put in, that the scholarship alone isn't enough. They're entitled to some sort of payment. Now, that's an interesting concept, but it would radically change college athletics. We could expect to see high school kids with agents. We could expect to see bidding wars, not just in terms of who gets a scholarship, but maybe an extra $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 to play college ball. We might even see college students who are sitting around, and you say you'll pay you'll play guard for $50,000 for the season, and I might come in and say, I'll take the job first string guard for $20,000. Right? Now we got the students bidding among themselves, and we've got the universities deciding whether they want to go with a bunch of cheap students and save some money or pay for the, you know, this is a very strange thing, and yet, on the face of it, most people would say we'd like to keep college athletics pure. But I think one of the things you're saying is it's really not pure. It's not pure to start with. And so why shouldn't the people that are really making the money get some of the money?
Well, Alfred, let me, in the time that I have left, let me make this very clear point. There is a man by the name of Walter Byers, and he's actually a Rice graduate. Walter Byers was the man who created he didn't create the NCAA, the National College Athletic Association that oversees all college athletics, but he was the head executive of the NCAA from, I believe, 1951 to 1988, you know, the early 50s to the late 80s, for over 30 years. He, in 1995, he wrote a book called Unsportsmanlike Conduct, The Exploitation of College Athletics. This is the man that made the NCAA the powerful system that it is. He was a man that was crucial in the coining of the phrase student athlete for the explicit purpose of denying that the athletes are actually employees, which I say they are by the definition of the word. But his opinion is that they should be paid. His opinion is that the whole system stinks of hypocrisy. And exploitation. You know, he calls the overseers of the programs, you know, he likens it to a plantation-like system where the players are, you know, in a plantation who worked on plantations but slaves and indentured servants. And he's saying, and these aren't my words, this isn't my notion, and I frankly had no opinion on all this before I started working for the program, but when you're actually in the presence of this place that has turned its love of money into this grotesque art, so to speak, and you just can't help but to feel some degree of resentment for the blatant hypocrisy about it all, that it's so in your face, and they don't even care that it's in your face. They don't even care that you know it, that it's what it's all about. And so,
Charles, what we're going to have to do is tell them where they can get a copy of your book again, and then we've got about 10 seconds before we have to close down.
Okay, goldenbevo.com, goldenbevo.com, goldenbevo.com.
Okay, Charles, thanks very much. Charles Torello, author of Tales from the Golden Bevo. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. I want to thank all of you for listening. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Charles, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a thing.